So in 2024, the wildly popular runaway movie hit is the movie Wicked, and it's carrying on its popularity into 2025. Now digital sales have just begun on streaming services like Apple, and though we don't know those numbers so far in the box office, Wicked has made over $635 million worldwide ticket sales, and that makes it the highest grossing Broadway adaptation ever. And if you don't know the movie, it's the most recent kind of telling of part of the story of The Wizard of Oz, starring, of course, Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo and Jeff Goldblum, just to name a few. So some big stars in it, big musical. Not only has it had a huge success in, maybe you didn't even know this, but it's been running on Broadway for over 20 years, making it the third longest running show on Broadway. And it has grossed over $5 billion with over 8,000 performances just on Broadway. That doesn't include the 15 other countries and 100 other cities that it plays in. So this storyline's been going on for some time now. And maybe you haven't seen it, maybe you don't intend to see it. So if not, let me catch you up just a little bit. If this is a spoiler alert, too bad, it's been out for 20 years and I don't know what else to tell you. But it's not really a sequel, it's not even really a prequel to The Wizard of Oz. It's a, we'll call it a side story, in which there's two big characters, Elphaba Thorpe, and of course, Glinda Upland. And Elphaba is the green-skinned outcast, unpopular, ugly by all of the standards, when you compare her to Glinda Upland, who's gorgeous and popular and has this beautiful voice. And the story revolves around this unlikely friendship that develops between the two of them. But the bigger story at hand is this. We know that Elphaba becomes, with her green skin, becomes the character we would know as the Wicked Witch of the West. And Glinda becomes Glinda the good witch of the South. But in this telling, in the story of Wicked, we find out that maybe Wicked isn't really that wicked. We discover that Elphaba isn't who we later think she is in The Wizard of Oz. And Glinda maybe isn't as good and pure as we thought she might have been as portrayed in The Wizard of Oz. It comes down to the fact that the great and powerful Wizard of Oz, in order to maintain control over the Kingdom of Oz, needs for there to be a villain. And if there's a villain, there needs to be a hero. And so he puts into effect this plan that villainizes Elphaba, turns her into this wicked witch, assigns the name and the title, the moniker, the reputation around her, and then they raise up Glinda to be, of course, the good and the pure. Now, what I like about that is it is a fairly accurate telling of the fact that there are narratives in our life that persuade us, that move us, that convince us or coax us into believing that something is good and something is evil, because we do tend to live in a world that requires we categorize everything in one or the other. We're very slow to get into that messy gray area and allow something to be something that it's not. We like this story because we are by nature storytellers ourselves. You might not think you're a good storyteller, but every day you tell a story to yourself and about yourself. And what I mean is that you are living out your story. You narrate your own story with your thoughts and sometimes even your words. And in your story, there's a plot that's unfolding in front of you. Now, you might not control how all of that plot plays out. There are characters in your story that affect you, that impact you. And in doing so, you get to portray yourself and everyone else in your life as the character that you need them to be. And can I tell you that we are almost always the hero in our story? It's so weird. We're never the villain. In the story of your marriage, are you ever the villain? No. You're not the villain. Now, you might have done something that a hero mistakenly does, because heroes are human too, but you're never the villain. And at work, you're never the villain. And in friendships, you're never the villain. And in all of Christendom, you're never the villain. And in morality, you're never the villain. And in finances, you're never the villain. Everything is someone else's fault, and everything is meant to disrupt the goodness of your life. Right? Now, we might not be overtly conscious that we're writing our story that way, but we tell our story in such a way that allows us during our tragedies and during the romance and during the comedy and during the mystery and during the plot twist of our story, it helps us keep in line which is which. We're never Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West. We always think we're Glinda the Good. And like the great and powerful Oz, we pull levers and knobs and we make lots of noises and we put up smoke and we create imagery which helps us convince ourselves and convince those in our lives, this is who everyone is. This is the cast of characters. If you want to know who someone's villain is, let them talk long enough. If you want to find out how bad something's going in somebody's life, let them talk about it, and then just give them enough space, and I promise you, they will reveal to you who the villain is in their story. It's probably why we like others to feed our plot line, to feed our affirmations of who the villain is. So we tend to listen to the news. We tend to listen to talking heads. We tend to listen to relationships. We tend to listen to or watch or tune in to social media that affirms what we believe so that we can encourage ourselves. We can feed the bias that these things are wrong. These things are evil. These people are evil. These are the villain. Anyone that doesn't agree with me, that doesn't line up with the way I see the world, anyone that doesn't play their part the way they're supposed to, there's others that also think you're the villain. So we're storytellers. And we're directors. Directors that decide which is which. We get to pick the villains and the heroes. But we would be wrong almost all the time. I mean, we would be wrong about who's the hero and who's the villain, who's good and who's evil. And the reason we'd be wrong is because we rarely ever get it right. Because I promise you this, in someone else's version, in someone else's story, that person you think is the villain is someone else's hero. And the person you're calling the villain, in their own story, they see themselves as the hero. For having stood up to you, for having not taken your stuff, for whatever it is, whatever drama's unfolding, I promise you that everybody has a different idea of who's good and who's evil. So it's important we figure out how to really know the difference between who's the villain and who's the hero. And here's how we do that. Grab your notes if you don't already have them out, or you can open up the app. By the way, our app dropped off of the app stores. It's back on Apple. We're having a hard time getting it back onto, what's the other one? The Android. I don't know why you're carrying an Android, but anyway. All right, calm down. I'm the villain in that, right? I got it. If you want to know who the villains and heroes really are, then you have to remember this. Evil always hides what it really is. If I'm going to know for certain who the villains and the heroes really are in my story, in any story, I have to remember that evil always hides what it is. So don't get me wrong. I believe that there is evil. There is wickedness in the world. And I would even go as far as to say there are people who do evil things and wicked things. And I'm not even saying those things don't ultimately reveal themselves. What I am saying is this: evil, true wickedness, doesn't want to be known. It doesn't want to be seen. It wants to operate in the shadows and in darkness as long as possible, because something that's overtly evil in your face, we all push back on. But something that can operate in the shadows and behind the scenes can get away with its behavior for as long as possible. So most of the things that we think are evil or that we call wicked or that we assign those titles are usually just things that rub us the wrong way, that we don't happen to agree with, that happen to be something that counters our opinions or our beliefs or our morality about one thing or the other. They might not be truly evil things. They just happen to be things we don't like. True wickedness hides in the darkest places of our hearts. And I say our hearts because almost none of us include ourselves in the camp of wickedness. Listen to Jesus' words in John 3:20-21. He says this: "Everyone who does evil deeds hates the light." Now, you might not think anything you've done is evil. We'll get to that down the road a bit. They will not come into the light. They're afraid that what they do will be seen. But anyone who lives by the truth comes into the light. They live by the truth with God's help, and they come into the light so that it'll be easy to see their good deeds. So I'm not going to go into the definitions of good and evil. We're going to do that in the upcoming weeks. But what I will say is this: Jesus identifies that truth is the opposite of evil. That light, exposure of our hearts, our intentions, our motives, our behaviors, our thoughts, exposing us is what good looks like. Because if you can be in the light and be exposed and there's nothing to be ashamed of, then that puts you in the camp of good. He says truth helps people be in the light. So I want to ask you this: have you ever been dishonest about anything? Have you ever hid anything? Do you want everything about your life to be on display? I remember the biggest threat I remember as a teenager in youth ministry growing up was when my youth pastor said, "And when we get to heaven, everything we've ever done will be displayed on a big screen." And I was like, a teenage boy does not want to hear that, right? So my question to you is this: with that definition of what evil looks like, would you maybe say that you fit the category of those who don't want light on your life, those who don't want truth exposing what you've been deceitful about? We never in our story consider ourselves the doer of evil or the one who hates the light, because it doesn't allow us, when we see ourselves as one of them, it doesn't allow us to then judge people for their evilness and their wickedness. It doesn't allow us the moral posturing, the ability to virtue signal to everyone how we don't do that and we don't believe that and we don't vote that way. We don't want to see ourselves like that. But Isaiah 5:20 says it this way: "It'll be very bad for people who call evil things good, and they call good things evil, and they say it's light when it's actually dark, and they say it's dark when it's actually light. They say things that are bitter that are sweet, and they say things that are sweet that are bitter." The point is this: if you and I call the evil things we do, the sinful things we do, the things that we are knowingly doing that are contrary to God's plan, God's will, God's character, contrary to who he's created us to be and how to live our story, and we call those things good because we think we've got good motives for them. I've heard a lot of people. So, you know, there's a story in the news right now. Obviously, this guy, Luigi Mangione, allegedly went and shot the CEO of United Healthcare right on the streets. And I was shocked. I mean, genuinely shocked at the level of approval that swept through the nation. I get the outrage. I get the hatred of the system that leaves so many uncared. I get all of that. But I thought, people are genuinely rationalizing the cold-blooded murder of a husband, a father, a human being, because he happened to be the CEO of a company that they despised. And the widespread approval of all that. And people, in their rationalization, call that good. And I have to ask you this question. Do you think there's ever been a time when you've called something good that isn't good at all? Or called something evil that isn't evil at all? Said something was something that it wasn't, because it helped you maintain your narrative. Second thing is this: if I want to know who the villains and the heroes really are, I have to remember that good needs more from me than I'm usually willing to give. Good needs more from me than I'm usually willing to give. You know what's easy? Getting fat. All you have to do is eat whatever you want to eat, drink whatever you want to drink, and then do absolutely nothing. And you will get fat. I know from personal experience, that's exactly how it goes. I didn't start the new year like, you know what? I haven't been in a long time fat. And I feel like fat is something I want to try. I just, over the years, continued to order whatever I wanted off the menu and drink the as much soda as I wanted to drink and have as much dessert as I wanted to have. And I just didn't do anything else to stop that. You know what's hard? Getting ripped. I'm just saying, what? My sweater was pulling on my neck. I was just adjusting a little bit. It's hard with my trilateral triceps. Well, I don't know what they're called. Here's why. You can't, not only can you not eat whatever you want or drink as much as you want of whatever you want, you have to be very limited about what you eat, very selective about what you eat and drink. And not only that, even you have to eat things you don't want to eat. They're like, in order to get healthy, in order to get ripped, in order, you have to start eating these things. And you go, well, I don't really like those things. Well, that's the price to pay for that. And you don't even get to eat as much as you want of it. Elvis, in his later days, when he would get really, really heavy before a tour, they would put him on a Jell-O diet, just regular Jell-O. And the problem was, they said he would eat ungodly amounts of the Jell-O, right? Which wasn't benefiting him because it was all full of sugar. And that's sometimes maybe the way we're like broccoli, but I can have 42 pounds of broccoli or whatever it happens to be. And not only do you have to eat that way, then you have to go and actually do the exercising, and you have to lift weights, and there's a tearing of the muscle and healing of the muscle. And there's a lot of pain and discomfort that go along with being who you really want to be. And it's not even like you just do it once. I joined the gym with Lisa. She's kind of a gym rat. She loves going to the gym. She loves working out. She does it multiple times a week. And I went and I took a cycling class. Well, actually, I swam first because I thought swimming's like low impact. Swimming's pretty fun. I used to swim as a kid, right? I did it like a lap down the pool, and I'm like, is there more gravity in water? Like, I just feel like this is so hard. How is this so easy? Is it, I could stay out in the pool for 11 hours. I can't even go down to the end. And I'm looking at everybody else like, did I forget how to, it was so hard. So I thought, well, I'm not swimming, I guess. That's really hard. So then I thought, cycling, I know how to roll my knees over and over again. And then, you know, it's like, everybody, they're screaming into the microphone and it's like, stand up. And you're like, I was like, I never stood as a kid when I pedaled, or if I did, it was much easier than this. And I kind of do, and I'm like, this is what I have to look. This, I'm paying money to do this, to just get really, you don't get to do it once and then go, well, thank God that's over. I lost all the weight. I'm totally ripped now. I can just appear with my beach body. No, you got to keep doing it over and over again. Maybe you're ahead of me just a little bit. Doing good, being good, saying good things, acting good, thinking good, living a good life, it's hard. You want to be evil? Just do nothing. You want to slip into evil thoughts and evil words and evil behavior? Just do whatever you want to do, think whatever you want to think, say whatever you want to say, act however you want to act, and you will become evil. Because we lean into the sin that gratifies what we want. You want to do good, it's hard. Here's how I know it's hard, because even in Galatians 6:9, Paul tells the church this: we have to continue to do things that are good. Paul's telling people who are following the goodest man to ever live. Jesus was inherently, supernaturally good, and he says, we want to emulate Jesus, but you have to continue to do good, as we should not get tired of doing the good things. If we do not feel weak and stop doing good things, then we'll receive a good harvest at the proper time. Paul's saying, listen, I know it's hard. It's a workout. You're going to stretch all kinds of muscles. You're going to have to do things you don't want to do. You're going to have to stop doing things you do want to do. You're going to grow tired of doing good things, but you've got to keep doing it, because if you do, it produces good things, rewarding things for your lives and the lives of those who you did good for. Good is hard. In Hebrews, he tells the Jewish Christians this: don't forget to do good things. That's how easy it is to do whatever you want instead of the things that you should be doing. Don't forget to do good things for others and share what you have. Listen, these are the kinds of sacrifices that please God. It takes something from you to do good. So when you say you're good, I want to challenge you on that. You're good only if you are putting in the work to be good, because good is hard. Good doesn't come naturally. It doesn't come easily. Good takes effort. You have to get up every day and not forget to do it, because it's easy to forget to do good, and it's hard to do it, and you'll grow tired of doing it. It's so much easier to just do whatever you want, to say whatever you want and be whoever you want. Third and finally is this: if I want to know who the villains and heroes really are, then I have to remember that I don't live in a world of easy absolutes. So I remember a time when we were all allowed to have an opinion, right? It was a long time ago. Those old enough probably remember it as well. And it's before social media existed. It's actually even before cell phones existed. Yes, there was a time when I remember my grandpa had one of the first cell phones. It was a bag phone, right? And it had it was like a military setup, a big antenna that came out of it, and radiation and all kinds of things happening, right? But in this time, before all that existed, and before there were 32 news channels on 24 hours a day, there was like ABC, NBC, and CBS. And I remember Fox coming on. I was like crazy to add a fourth. I was like, what is happening? This is the greatest world, right? And news was like 30 minutes of local news and then like 30 minutes or maybe an hour of national. That was it. And so the amount of information that you received on a daily basis, it had to come from actually talking to other human beings. Right? There was conversations that happened. And in those conversations, we had beliefs and we had ideas and opinions that were nuanced and complex and faceted and dimensional. And there was some depth to them that you had to think it out. And if you didn't think it out and you just blurted out some really ridiculous thought, somebody would go, I don't know, is that really true though? Do you think? And you could argue it out kind of in this sieve where you go, oh, okay, I didn't know that. And you didn't assume you knew everything, because information, it moved slower and it had to be really processed out. And now though, we watch a 30-second TikTok on something and we think we've got all the information we need to determine what side we're on an issue, or who we're going to vote for, or who did the wrong thing and who did the right thing. And we have news people, news, I put that in quotation marks. We have somebody who gives a little bit of information and then they take literally an hour and just speculate. And there's a lot of opinions and ideas and get thrown around. The fact of the story, that got lost way, 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 way back in the beginning. And it's just then, and it gets us all worked up emotionally. And there's a real problem with that. The problem is that we've been put into polarized camps of really having to decide, because it's so messy, it's so frustrating, it's so unsettling for us to stay in that tension where we don't know, that we just decide we're going to know. We just decide we know. It doesn't matter if we've got all the facts, it doesn't. And scientists tell us that once we've decided that we know something, it's very, very hard to move us off that. You could bring facts and proof, and it really doesn't even matter. I brought this up before. I'm fascinated that there are people who believe, still believe. Now, I understand there was a time in history when this would have been a logical conclusion, but that still believe we're on a flat earth, that it's literally just a plane, and you could reach far enough to fall off the edge. And I actually saw a video of a guy who traveled to the North Pole, and where the sun is up constantly, and he didn't believe that, because in order for that to be true, the earth has to be a sphere, right? It has to be on the axis in which it's not moving off of that exposure to the sun the entire time it's moving around. So if it was a plane, there would always be a dark time on the earth, right? So he gets there and he just goes, this is an expensive trip, by the way. Like, he really was invested in this, and he just goes, yeah, I mean, sometimes in life you just find out you're wrong. He had to travel to the North Pole as a flat earther to find out the earth. I could have shown him a million pictures on the internet. We've got pictures of the earth. It's a big sphere, and you have to believe that that's fake in order to not believe that we took pictures from space. Are you getting my point? That we love to believe things that aren't true. We settle on an extreme. We move the pendulum to the right or the left because we love certainty. Certainty helps us feel settled, helps us feel secure, helps us feel safe. And so we assign in our lives titles of good and evil because it helps us feel like we can stay on the side of good. But I want you to hear this. This is King David, who the Bible describes, by the way, as a man after God's own heart. David wasn't a perfect man, but I want you to listen. He says this in Psalm 141:4. Don't let my mind want evil things. Don't let me join with wicked people to do the same bad things that they do. I don't even want to eat their good food. I love that David is praying a prayer that all of us should pray. David's prayer is a recognition that he has the potential to want evil, the potential to do evil, the potential to be enticed by good food. And maybe we can take food beyond just the literal and recognize it as this: good beliefs and good feelings and good positions and good opinions, whatever it is that entices us into a thing we see that we say, I like that. I like the way they talk. I like the boldness. I like the way that they stand up. I like the way that they assert themselves. I like this. We like things that help us feel good about who we are and what we're thinking and what we're doing and what we're saying. But David said, don't let me get trapped. Don't let me get pulled into all that. I have the capacity. David was a good man at times, but he was inarguably an evil man at times. He lusted after somebody else's wife, called her into his kingdom, into his palace, so that he could have an adulterous sexual relationship with her, got her pregnant, called her husband off the front lines, had him murdered, conspired with others to have him murdered. This is a man after God's own heart, mind you. Easy for someone to say David's an evil man. He had done evil things, and at times he was an evil man, but David is also the writer of the Psalms. David also conquered lions and bears and the giant because of his faith in God. David wrote Psalms at a time when he was being chased by Saul for no good reason at all. David was simply a righteous man, found Saul sleeping in a cave, could have killed him and didn't, because he honored who God had in a position of leadership. And he went back and he repented to God and to Saul for having almost been tempted to kill him. Was David a good man? He was. Was David an evil man? He was. Are you getting my point? You aren't everything you think you are. If you think you're evil, you're not. If you think you're good, you're not. Because we don't live in a world of moral, spiritual, relational, financial, political absolutes. We live in that messy gray area. Let me end with this. Paul wrote to the church, the Romans, who were made up of primarily Jews with a lot of Gentile new believers coming in. And they were struggling with what it took to be a genuine follower of Christ. Those who were Hebrew, Jewish Christians, believed that, and they even verbalized it, you had to follow the law. Jesus came to fulfill the law, but they saw fulfillment as he came to solidify and put a stamp of approval on the law. And Paul constantly had to challenge that belief because they were still relying on the law to make them righteous. And he used his own life as an illustration of how it's simply not that simple. And here's what he said. I know that in me, that is in my fallen human nature, in who I am without God, there is nothing good. I can will myself to do something good, but that doesn't help me carry it out. I can want it really badly. And I can determine that I'm going to, I can decide it that I'm going to do good. I still don't do it. Instead, I end up living out the evil that I decided not to do. I can want it. I can will it. I can decide. I can try and act on it. And ultimately, I still end up doing the bad thing. All of our wanting in the world, all of our trying in the world doesn't make us good. Paul illustrated that there is no amount of certainty about anything that can make you a better person. Am I certain that there is a God? I believe there's a God. But if I'm looking for certainty, I'm in the wrong business. I'm certain that I'm standing on a stage because I've stood on it many, many, many times, and I can feel it and see it and measure it, and I can quantify it with all those human things that I've got to measure what's real and what's not real. But when it comes to things like faith, and is there a God, and who is God, and who is Jesus, those things require me to admit that certainty is not where my growth, maturity, and goodness come from. And maybe if we pulled back a little bit, we wouldn't be so quick. You know, I know there's people who maybe don't want to see the movie Wicked because there's witches in it. But there was in Wizard of Oz. I don't know if you ever saw The Wizard of Oz, right? It's like the purest, cutest movie in the world. And there was witches. I'll just let you know that. And they did witchcraft. And it's a movie, by the way, right? Those aren't real witches. And maybe there are still witches in the world. I don't know, right? My point is this. There are Christians who have gotten so worked up because other Christians are going to see the movie Wicked. And I just think, that's your battle? That's what you picked? There's children being molested and families starving, and there's genocide across the planet, and you're pissed about Wicked? About fictional witches? Or about the fact that I just said pissed on the stage? Right? You're like, well, I missed it the first time. You didn't have to say it again. I think we're just so quick to encamp things where it makes us feel better about us. Because if I can make a pile of everything that's evil, it's massive compared, right? I just go, look at all the evil. It's so rare to be this good. Right? I stand in the margins with just the few other good people that exist in this world. I'm one of the good ones. We never see ourselves as the evil character, as the villain of the story. If we did, it might help us have a little bit more empathy. And I'm not talking for the child molesters, the Hitlers, the genocidal tyrants that so boastfully and so unashamedly rule their lives through evil. I'm talking about the people like David that exist in our lives. We are David. On one moment, we might be a man or a woman after God's own heart, and at the next, we might be lusting and conspiring to do wrong to satisfy a desire in our lives, because that is the nature of our struggle. We don't always know which is which. We all think we're Glinda the Good. But we might be surprised to find out that she's not really that good. Does some pretty mean, underhanded, selfish things. And Elphaba might be just terribly misunderstood. I'm not telling you to go see a movie. What I'm telling you is to expand your ideas that allow you to conceive the fact that we don't always know what things truly are or who, more importantly, someone truly is. Will you bow your heads and close your eyes so that we can just have a moment with this? And God, I'm praying for all of us here that we could set aside whatever it is we've picked up along the way, our upbringing, our belief system, our religious context, our tendencies, our habits of being quick. Just as the prophet was ready to choose the next king as God had assigned him to do with David's family, and he went through and he was looking at all the military-esque and physically strong and the charismatic sons. And God told him, I don't look at any of that. I look on the heart. And so in that, David, the scrawny, the young, the unprepared, the uneducated, the unpopular, the unpicked for everything else, became God's chosen. And we are so quick to use external standards. First, God, help us see ourselves for who we truly are. We're not good. Paul said it about himself. I would venture to say Paul's a better man than I am and did more for the kingdom of God than I'll ever do and was bolder in his faith than I'll ever be. And Paul said about himself, there is nothing in me by myself, my sinful fallen nature alone that makes me good at all. I can't be good even if I want to be good. And so there's not a single person in this room without you that is good. We don't have it in us to be good. We will get fat with our own selfishness and our own desires and our own wants and our own needs. We just have to keep feeding that in order to become the evil we say we hate so much. But I think more likely, like David, we long after you. We want to be good. We want to do the right thing, like Paul said. And instead of justifying or rationalizing the bad we do and calling it good, maybe we just rationalize, you know what, I'm never going to be wholly good. And because of that, I don't have to require someone in my life to be wholly good. I can empathize and be sympathetic with the fact that people can mess up and things aren't always what they seem to be. And I have to recognize that it's not a world of absolutes and I don't always know who's evil and who's good or what's evil and what's good. And I've got to stop. I've got to stop just assigning names to things and really discover maybe for the first time what genuinely truly is good and what genuinely and truly is evil, so that I can use my energy, my effort, my beliefs, my opinions, my all that I am, my story, to launch a true battle against what is truly evil in the world. And I believe that's a story worth living and a story worth telling, and we need your help to do it. But help us with awareness of ourselves and an empathy and compassion for others. In Jesus' name, amen.